Well, hello and welcome back to another episode of the Asking for a Friend podcast. It's an elder-led ministry of Believers Baptist Church in Emory, Texas. And my name is Duffy Henderson, and I'm your host. The Asking for a Friend podcast exists as a weekly resource for the edification and the benefit of God's people. So here we hope to provide helpful, thoughtful, and most importantly, biblical material as we address everyday life questions and issues. So if you find this podcast helpful, please take a few moments to share it with someone that you think would also benefit from it. Thanks for listening in today, and may the Lord bless this episode in particular greatly to you as a means of grace for your spiritual growth and your benefit. And this evening, we're recording, this is one of the later times that we've done a podcast recording, but I'm here with my co-host, Jason Rowland, one of our elders here at the church. Jason, it's good to be with you this evening. How are you tonight?
I'm doing well, Duffy. It is good to be with you and be able to record this podcast with our guest and looking forward to it.
Absolutely. And I'll just do a brief introduction. He probably doesn't need any introduction, but this is one of our guests today is Dr. James White. He is an elder, pastor at Apologia Church in Arizona. And he is, I think this is the 40-year mark, if I'm not mistaken, for Alpha and Omega Ministries, which is just phenomenal. There's just a wealth of information on their website from many years of being in the public ministry of the word, whether it be in apologetics, evangelism, writing books, public debates, all of that. So we are excited to welcome Dr. James White to the podcast. Dr. White, I know it's been a long day. You're on the beginning of a road trip. I know you've had a tough day on the road, but we are so glad to have you. How are you doing this evening?
Oh, not too bad. Not too bad. You didn't mention that I'm also one of your professors. I don't know.
I figured you'd bring that up.
Enter into anything. So I teach GGBTS. I used to Golden Gate Baptist Theological Seminary.
Yep, yeah. Yep.
I had to say two G's at that one. And then they become Gateway. Isn't mm-hmm. that what they changed to? I have no idea. I think they're in LA now, aren't they? Or something like that. I don't know. They had a beautiful campus in Mill Valley. I don't know if you've ever been there. Of course, Mill Valley is right next to San Francisco, so I'm not sure it's all that beautiful anymore. But taught for them for years and years and years. And that was a very interesting experience up until the day that Paige Patterson picked up the phone and called the president of Golden Gate and had me fired. So for being reformed. I have lots of stories that I could tell you. We're starting a 33-day trip. A couple days ago. Today was the longest leg. So that was my mistake to try to put too much in one day. But I'm currently in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and rushed to get set up here. This should look a lot prettier than it is. I apologize. You should see what it looks like on the 4K camera that I have up there. It's beautiful. Unfortunately, I can't connect that to you. There is a way to do it, but it would have delayed us by another hour or so. So we're just going to have to go with the MacBook camera here and not the beautiful 4K camera. But hey, it's staring at me. So ugly is ugly in 4K or 1080p, you know, it doesn't matter.
Well, I know that technology rarely works like it ought to, or at least like we would like it to, right? We buy all this new gear and we plug it in and then we realize, we forgot this or this doesn't work. And it's just the nature of technology. And the more you add to it, sometimes the more complicated it gets.
The more stuff can break. That's how it works.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, so before we dive into kind of the meat of the episode, I did want to just give you a few minutes just to talk about personal ministry updates. You can talk about the trip that you're on. I know G3 Conference is coming up in a couple of months, and just this will be your time just to let folks know kind of what you're doing lately, any projects that you're working on, if you are, just kind of open the floor for you.
Yeah, well, I've been going up to Colorado in the summers since 2011. And I'm not sure how many more years I'm going to be able to do this, but I've done intense, insane bicycle races and rides up in Colorado. So I try to build stuff around that. And one was called the Triple Bypass bike ride, which everybody always goes, "You had a triple bypass?" No, I did have cardiac ablation, but I have not had a triple bypass yet. You go over three passes. That's why it's called a triple bypass. And it's in one day, you ride 120 miles. You climb 10,500 feet. The lowest you ever are is 7,500 feet above sea level. And the highest is 12,000 feet above sea level.
Wow.
I did that. And in fact, I did the double triple three times, which you would do that one day, stay the night, and then ride back the next day. So that's pretty intense. And then you have the Mount Evans hill climb, which I will do this year. And that one's only 26 miles long, but you start at 7,500 feet and you climb the top of Mount Evans. I don't know if you've ever been to the top of Mount Evans, but Mount Evans is the highest paved road in North America. The finish line for that race is 14,130 feet above sea level. Wow. So there is half the oxygen at that level there is where you are in Texas. And so it's just straight up. And by the time you get to about 12,000 feet, it feels like you have lead in your wheels instead of air. And that's less than 2 weeks from now for me.
Oh, wow.
I am not at all prepared for it acclimation-wise. This is going to be survival only. And I've entered into my seventh decade and my body's falling apart. So I was in 2016, I was a monster. I could ride anybody my age off my wheel. It was great, but a lot of stuff has happened since 2016. And, I'm about 35 pounds heavier than I was then. And, stuff just doesn't work. We won't ask, we can't ask you anything about that, 'cause you're just a kid. But there might be other people on the program that understand that.
I understand, brother.
As the body gets older, stuff just doesn't work the way it used to. And of course, I've developed some real nice ministry opportunities, connections up there. I'll be at Redemption Hills Church. They're having me do a little conference on the kingdom of God. And Duffy would be sitting in the front row going like that during half of it. Unless he wanted to get a good grade in the future, then he might not do that. But and then I'll be between the two rides. I'm shooting from Colorado all the way up to Ely, Minnesota. I called it Eli because it's E-L-Y, but I've been told it's Ely, Minnesota, which is about as close to Canada as I want to get these days. Little church up there. And this is one of the things I like about doing the things the way I'm doing it now. Up through 2019, I wasn't spending a lot of time in the United States as far as traveling was concerned at all. In 2019, I flew 165,000 miles. I taught in Samara, Russia, Kyiv, obviously the war hadn't started yet, Durban, South Africa, Johannesburg, Melbourne, Australia. I was in Melbourne only a matter of weeks before COVID hit. I'm glad I got out, because if you remember, they shut the place down. There were people trapped out there. And I got out of there. I spent 2 months in London in 2019. So I was I had every flight access in the world, you know, executive platinum on American and British Airways and global access and all that stuff.
And now you're in an RV.
And now I'm in an RV in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And people go, "Wow, what happened? How the mighty have fallen." But it's absolutely purposeful on my part, because what happened was I did mention that I had cardiac ablation in 2011, but it didn't take. So my heart can start going really, really fast at times. And it used to be just when I was riding. Now it can happen almost anytime. So that's one of the things that slowed me down, is it's happening more and more frequently. You put a mask on me and it's like a switch. And so I'll go into what's called supraventricular tachycardia. Say that three times fast. And that's much more dangerous than COVID was by a long shot. And the problem is nobody cared. The airlines didn't care. And for years we have been giving, you know, in 2019, I think we paid $150 to $150, somewhere around $1,000 in ticket fees to the airlines for flights around the world. And it's like, you know, I'm not really sure I want to give you my money anymore. You don't really care about me. You wouldn't work with me, and you didn't care about my life. It was like, go away or die, one of the two. And so it's sort of like, we decided to, starting in 2021, things were still locked down. Now they're doing the vax stuff and everything else. I wasn't doing that. I was department fellow anatomy and physiology in college. I've seen through this stuff for a long time. But anyway, we just made the decision. You know, one day I went, I wonder if I could RV. I had never RV'd in my life. I had stayed in an RV for like two nights in Alaska once on a trip up there. But I didn't have any idea how it worked, anything like that. And so we rented a little 19-foot long self-contained RV. Within 4 hours of picking it up, I destroyed the air conditioner by hitting a basketball hoop with it. But I tried to put that aside.
Rookie move.
Big rookie move. And I drove out to Pryor, Oklahoma, and for ministry at Derek Melton. I think you may know Derek.
I know of him, yeah.
Yeah, Derek was, for years, when I first started going to Pryor, he was second command of the police department. In Pryor, he was head of the SWAT team. And also pastor that church. And then he retired from police and full-time with that. And the thing he started doing after he retired is he watched YouTube videos and started making knives. And I'm not talking about buying parts. He has a forge. He forges these things from the ground up. And they are beautiful. I don't know if you've seen them, but he is a master at it. So I went to his church, little RV. He helped me tape up the air conditioner so it stopped raining inside the unit. Stuff like that. Oh, it was fun. I got back and said, you know, I think I can do this. And so it's not this unit we bought. We've already gone through one unit. This is supposed to be a real nice studio that I'm in right now. And it is a really nice studio. If I wasn't rushing so much tonight, we would have been able to work it out, because I do have a satellite that I could have set up. But this is how I travel now. And so when I go to G3, as you mentioned, in September, I will drive across the United States. I'm going to do a conference the weekend before in Pennsylvania, in the Lancaster-Carlisle area, in maybe a debate as well in that area. And then down to Atlanta. My wife's going to fly in and be at G3 with me for the first time. That'll be enjoyable. And then on the way back, I'll be doing a conference in Louisiana. And then when I get back only a couple days before we have, and I'm not supposed to know a lot about this, but our 40th anniversary celebration there in Phoenix for Alpha Omega, because we incorporated amazingly enough in 1983. When I was, 20. Yeah. I hadn't quite turned 21 yet. When we actually started. So we're going to have a little get together, with a bunch of folks, to celebrate 40 years. 'Cause most apologetics ministries don't go 40 years. There's a lot of flash in the pan stuff when it comes to apologetics, but, we've been around for 40 years now. And so we're going to be doing that. So yeah, it's, you know, I go up to Ely. How in the world did I find out about Ely? Well, the pastor up there is friends with the pastor of a church in St. Charles, Missouri, that I've gone to the first weekend in December for 22 years. And so there is connection. And as I'm going along these things, people have sent in, I have a map and little churches, big churches, doesn't matter. If I'm coming through and they want to, and they're like, well, I don't care if it's Tuesday, I don't care if it's Thursday, Friday, whatever. If you're coming through, let us know. We'll try to work something out. And so I get to go to a lot of churches like that. I was in a church over in Lubbock. I think I think it was the night after I was with you guys, if I recall correctly.
Yep.
And I had a pair of brothers that drove down there from Kansas.
Oh, wow.
Just for my, and I was only, you know, I only spoke for an hour and 10 minutes or something like that, but they drove all the way from Kansas, just to be there for that kind of thing. So I just sort of feel like we're seeing the fruit of 40 years now. You get to hear all the stories and meet the people that, yeah, you get to meet a lot of these folks at a place like G3. I'll stand at our table for 3 hours in a row and take selfies of people and get exposed to every form of COVID, A, Alpha, Delta, whatever. I got exposed to every kind of COVID there was at G3 and never got it. And that's enjoyable too. And I love taking the selfies and signing the books and everything like that. But it's different. I was at a little Baptist church in Louisiana, and again, people had driven so far to be there. And then just to sit there, and they made the best lemon cookies on the planet. Oh, those were good. You know, you get that home, especially the desserts, the home cooked desserts, stuff like that. And I'm just sitting there at these 6 foot tables, and it's Louisiana, so it smells a little musty, you know, because it's always humid in Louisiana. And people just sitting there, and they're, you know, when someone sits down next to you and they sort of wait till other people have moved away a little bit and their eyes start tearing up before they start talking to you, okay, you get sort of focused. And when someone says, you know, the dividing line, our webcast, wasn't a dividing line for me, it was a lifeline. And then they tell you their life story and how the dividing line helped get them out of this cult or this situation or kept them from going into this. That's why you do it. That's why you've been doing it for 40 years. And by traveling this way, I get to hear these stories that I generally would not get to hear as much. Now, one thing I do need to point something out. I about fainted years ago when I went to Potchefstroom, South Africa, where Northwest University used to be Potchefstroom University. And I did a debate with a Muslim there. I did a lot of debates in South Africa. And I had a homeschool family walk up to me. And these kids are just so excited because they've been watching me for years and years and years. It's Potchefstroom, South Africa, for crying out loud, you know? So there were really exciting situations. There was two times in South Africa. It was really weird how it almost mirrored it. There were years between them. We're a group of about four or five black South Africans. And I mean, black, deep Central African South. I mean, they're just very, very black. And they came up to me and they said, Dr. White, we just, you know, we go to university in Johannesburg or wherever it was. A lot of the universities down there are very liberal. And they said, if it wasn't for the dividing line, we would not have been able to keep our faith. That's what got us through university. And we've never spent a dime to advertise the dividing line. Not once. We've never bought advertising. We don't have people who maintain donor lists. Rich and I stink at fundraising. So it's absolutely amazing that as far as global apologetics webcasts, there's nobody that comes even close to the dividing.
Yeah,
as far as true. I mean, we have a huge global audience, and it's all word of mouth. It's completely. I can't tell you how many times someone will come up to me and hey, you know, I was watching some Jeff Durbin videos, and then yours popped up, and that's how I found out about you. Or I was watching you, and some Jeff Durbin videos popped up. That's how I found out about him. Jeff and I are sort of joined at the hip as far as that kind of stuff goes, but it's just word of mouth. Yeah. This is a unique period in church history.
Yep.
Very unique period in church history where I can be almost anywhere in the world and communicate with people all over the world. And I don't know if we will always have this privilege. I can guarantee you there are people in charge right now that wish we didn't have this privilege. But right now we have it. So someone once said, you must work while the sun shines. And so that's what we're seeking to do. And if we're doing it in a little different way, hey, look, if COVID 24 comes along and they say vaxxed or no travel, all you guys are going to be coming to me and asking how to do it. Because and I've said that to Doug Wilson. I said, you know, we were talking about, you know, every time I've gone up to Moscow, I've done it in the RV. And we were talking about something. He was flying somewhere. And I said, well, someday, he says, yep, I know who I'll be coming to get all my RV information when I can't fly anymore. We know who to talk to. So
You'll be experienced by then.
I've already pulled this thing over 40 miles.
Uh-oh, we lost you for a second.
Uh-oh, really?
Uh-oh, yep. Okay, now you're back. Still here. Little blip.
Well, that's interesting because I was drinking right as it blipped. So maybe maybe Zoom automatically edits drinks. I don't know.
So you've pulled the RV for many miles. I think that's what you were saying.
About 40,000 miles. And oh. I did want to show you all and your listeners only something that other people will have to wait to G3 to see. What do you think about that?
I love that.
Love it. Love it.
Okay. All right.
What do you have?
So, the last time I spoke at a regional conference in Washington, D.C. for G3 last year, but I think the last national conference was in 21. Okay.
Yeah, I was there. Yep.
Okay. Do you remember? Okay, that's the one when I remember that's where they interrupted me and stopped me because they had the little kid that was lost.
I think so. Yeah, that's true.
And I've had,
I forgot about that.
I've had so many weird things happen to me while preaching at G3. The funniest one was years before that. I was 5 minutes into the sermon and all of a sudden I feel someone touching my back. And literally one of the sound guys had snuck up behind me. I'm at the pulpit and he's lifting my jacket up to do something with the microphone. And I didn't even hear him coming. Everybody else saw him coming. Talk about throwing you off your game.
Yep.
That was really, really interesting. But the year before that, I preached a sermon from Isaiah 6. And I did it from the Greek Septuagint. And Jeffrey Rice bound for me the Reader's Greek Septuagint, and it's in two volumes. It's huge. I actually wanted to look at putting it into one volume, but it would have been like this thick, and you're not going to be able to read it well. It's not going to lay open or anything like that. So I preached the sermon only from the Greek Septuagint. I didn't have any notes, and so I had to read the text from Isaiah 6 from the Septuagint. There was reason for that. If you go back and watch it, there's some really, really, really cool stuff. There's a textual variant in Isaiah 6:1 that's really important, in John 12:41, stuff like that. So what I wanted to do this year is the theme is the sovereignty of God. And thankfully, I got my requested text because I forget which year it was. I got outranked on a text. I asked for it first, but someone who will not be named. I'll just say this particular individual has extremely narrow culinary tastes. Okay. We'll just leave it at that. Wanted to do part of the same text that I was going to do. And so I had to change my direction because this particular individual outranks me. I'm not sure who made up the rankings, but anyway, so I got my text this year and I knew what I wanted to do. And so I asked Jeffrey about it. And so here is my, now this look a lot better 4K. So you'll see Biblia Hebraica.
Yeah.
So nice. This is actually an entire Bible, including the New Testament, in Hebrew.
Oh, wow.
And so it is as close as you're going to get to large print. It's hard.
I can almost
to find,
read that.
it's hard to find large print Hebrew. It really, really is. So I'm going to be in Isaiah. And so, Lord willing, this is the only thing I'll bring into the pulpit is this text. So this time I'll be translating from the Hebrew and then using that as my text. But what's amazing is I bought this. Now, I don't know if you can tell. It's sort of hard to tell. But this is the new, what he calls double shot leather that Jeffrey's using. It is just an incredible Bible leather. It's not goat skin. It is cow, I think. But anyways, it's beautiful leather. I don't know how he's learned to do this. But when I bought this, it came from Israel. You can buy it. They weren't all that expensive from the Israeli Bible Society, I think, or something like that.
Hmm.
And it already had gold edges. And so he said, what would you like me to dye it? And I was like, what? Somehow, I don't know how he does it. You can sort of see, it's really hard to get the
light. It's like a purple tint, isn't
there's,
it?
There's the gold.
Yeah.
But then when you open it up, it's purple.
That's cool.
That is cool.
So
can
it's
you
got
hear
purple,
me, Jeffy?
Yeah.
Purple liners, purple ribbons, and yet it's gold when you it's gold when it's there's gold, and you could there's a purple when it's open. I mean,
that's
wow.
Pretty.
And everybody freaked out when I showed it on Twitter because there's my name, and that looks like it's on the back. But it's a Hebrew Bible.
It's reversed.
So it's on everything, the front.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
I love it.
So fantastic. It is gorgeous. I bought a Bible cover for that one.
Can you divulge the text that you're going to be preaching from, or is that secret?
Oh, yes. I will be in Isaiah 41, focusing primarily on verse 21 and following.
All right.
The trial of the false gods, Isaiah 40-48, has since seminary, and I still can't remember seminary. It's amazing. I can't remember anything anymore, but I can remember seminary. It's always been one of my favorite texts. I think it's some of the richest theology in, especially theology of God in Scripture. And there is a key text in Isaiah 41, more than once, God challenges the false gods. And when you challenge false gods, do this, do that, what you're saying is, this is what the true God can do. This is what false gods can't do. And over again, tell us what's going to happen. Tell us what's going to happen. Tell us what's going to happen. So knowledge of future events is central to God's own self-apologetic and self-revelation. But in Isaiah 41:21, it's not just tell us what's going to happen. He does say that. But then he also says, and as for the former things, tell us their outcomes so we may consider them in our hearts. And that makes you go, whoa, wait a minute. God's saying, I can tell you what happened, what's going to happen in the future. But I can also tell you, not only what happened in the past, so God's the perfect historian, unlike the rest of us, but I can tell you why it happened. And you have to be the sovereign over time to be able to do both of those things. I don't know how an open theist deals with stuff like this. I mean, I've debated a number of open theists over the years. I may have actually thrown that at John Sanders the last time he and I were on Unbelievable. In London, I don't know, about 5 years ago or so. I don't think I understood his answer if I did. But anyway, it's a tremendous text, and so I'll be opening that one up from this text.
Cool.
This Hebrew text in September, Lord willing, and I don't get run off the road by a semi tractor trailer or something like that between here and there, because I got a lot of miles to drive between here and there.
So you're doing Arizona to Pennsylvania to Atlanta. Is that what you said?
And then down to Baton Rouge,
Holy
and then
moly.
the southern route back.
Wow.
That'll be the
Wow.
September
That
run.
is a trip.
Yeah, well, this one, Arizona to almost Canadian border and back again
A
is
serious trip as
pretty
well.
close. Yeah.
Wow.
But yeah, I think this one's like 4,300. I think September is 5,100
Oh, okay.
miles. Yes.
Wow.
Yep. So it's
Well,
I'll cover the USA.
yeah, in just a matter of months, just a matter of a few months. Well, so let's it was a good segue. I love the text you're going to be teaching from in G3. Looking forward to that. But I've got a couple of topics for us for just the listeners and kind of making this taking some theology and apologetics and kind of making it practical. And I've heard you speak on this. Anyone who's heard you on the dividing line, who's read any of your stuff, heard you preach, will know that one of the driving motivations of what you do is to be promoting the biblical literacy of both the pulpit and the pew. I've been impacted by your teaching, especially with just being aware of the text itself, knowing what's in the scriptures, not doing theology apart from the scriptures, but having your theology be rooted in the scriptures and not reversing that. You've talked about that in class before, and our apologetic is from scripture, not vice versa, right? And all of these things. And I think that there's just a general need. I've been a Christian for quite some time. Jason, probably twice as long as me. He's been pastoring as long as I've been alive. You've been doing Alpha and Omega Ministries and worldwide travel as long as I've been alive. And so you guys both know very well the need for biblical literacy. And just like, it's not enough to just own a Bible. We must know what's there. God has revealed himself. It is God's self-revelation to us. And just wanted you to riff off of that, but also you can kind of bring that conversation into our understanding of the Trinity and why that's important for Christians today. So kind of those two concepts. What are your thoughts there?
Well, really interesting because someone directed me in DM on Twitter. Someone else is involved in apologetics and said, "Hey, did you never comment on this? Did you see the?" He called it a debate, but it was a discussion between William Lane Craig and Dale Tuggy. And I said, no, I didn't know that it happened. Dale Tuggy is a Unitarian, a philosophical Unitarian. And I've talked about him a few times on the dividing line. I have avoided much interaction because, to be honest with you, Dale Tuggy sounds like he's bored. He really does every time he speaks. I have a hard time dealing with people who literally sound like I'd really rather doing anything but this, but since it's what I do, okay, this is why Jesus isn't God type of stuff. And it's just like, okay, whatever. Well, he had engaged my friend Michael Brown a couple of years ago, and that was an interesting debate. But I was really interested because William Lane Craig is not an Orthodox Trinitarian by his own self-admission. He calls himself a neo-Apollinarian. And the reason this is relevant to your question is he, on one hand, will say, well, we're Protestants, we believe in sola scriptura, and so I will hold any of the early church fathers or any of the early creeds to a biblical standard. Okay. All right. But then in this conversation, in the first half, Craig was defending his definition of the Trinity, which was extremely, I'm not sure how to describe it. It was narrow. It did not include, for example, it would not include the Chalcedonian definition. It would not include really the hypostatic union because he's a neo-Apollinarian. It's very Craig has always, Craig's, for many years, what he does is he tries to present as small a target for his opponent to shoot at as possible. And so in debates, like when he debated Shabir Ali, someone I've debated 7 or 8 times, on 3 different continents, and I think about 4 different continents. Wow. Anyways, when he debated Shabir Ali, Shabir Ali brought up the issue of original sin because it was sort of relevant to what they were saying. And he's like, oh, no, I'm not defending anything like that. And he wouldn't even go there. He always keeps a very narrow focus. And so the first half of the conversation is this hyper philosophical discussion of Craig's very unique doctrine, the Trinity, which wouldn't really correspond to almost any of the rest of us. And it was models versus models and this versus that. And there wasn't enough scripture in it. I don't know if any scriptures were even cited, to be perfectly honest with you. Mm-hmm. And then it switched halfway through to where now Tuggy has to defend his Unitarian views. And all of a sudden, Bill Craig is presenting Granville Sharp constructions at Titus 2:13 and 2 Peter 1:1 and the Carmen Christi at Philippians chapter 2 and John 1:1 and it's like, what just happened? But even then, while I was going, okay, right, you got to do John 20:28, you got to do John 1:1. But even then, what really concerned me was when he would go to John 1:1, what he would do is he would, instead of hanging the weight of the argument on the exegesis of the text, he hung the weight of the argument on all the Johannine scholars that I know say this. Well, the problem is anybody can find a Johannine scholar, because I mean, who gets to determine who that is in the first place, right? My thing just said your internet connection is unstable. Well, we'll see how that works out.
Go ahead.
I've always been concerned about how the Craig group of apologists will throw out all scholars say this or all scholars say that, because it's so easy to refute that. All you got to do, you can name 4, 5, 6 people and now the point's moot. So at one point Craig goes, and I'm not making an argument from authority. And I was driving at the time going, yes, you are. It's obvious. But at the same time, he did force Dale Tuggy to make a number of statements that I'm like, okay, we've got to cover this stuff on the dividing line, because this is so important. Over the years, I think some of the most important stuff we've done in helping train people is to go into the text and deal with key doctrinal issues and go, here's where the exegesis comes from. Here's when dealing with Roman Catholics and Romans 5:1, you need to see how Romans 5:1 is related to Romans 4:7 and 8, and you've got to ask them, who is the blessed man in Romans 4, because there is no blessed man in Roman Catholicism, because there is no non-imputation of sin. You work through these things and you help people see that the real foundation is not the agreement of all Pauline scholars, because there is no agreement of all Pauline scholars, or Johannine scholars. You show them what is actually right there in the text. You ground their faith in the divine word itself. And the things that Tuggy was saying, most seminary graduates would struggle to deal with, because we don't talk about this kind of stuff. I think we should. I do. but most classes don't. And to hear the other side making that argument, I just feel like it clarifies things. When you refute the other side's argument, it allows you to really clarify things in a way that, I mean, that's what I like about debates, is you can sit in a class and you can listen to a professor droning on about this doctrine, that doctrine, or whatever. But when you're, I was a Southern Baptist for a long time. In fact, I was ordained as a Southern Baptist. And I was at a church called North Phoenix Baptist Church, huge church, massive church, 20,000 members. And I was the one, even as a young person, when they would find that someone in our church, and sometimes they were just in a Bible study class or something, they weren't even members of the church, had gotten involved with a cult, Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, guess who they called? And so I remember really clearly one encounter I had with this Jehovah's Witness couple. This guy was sharp. Oh, my goodness, was he sharp. The only reason he and his wife left and that person didn't become a Jehovah's Witness and came back to North Phoenix, the only reason was because I was a second year Greek student and a good one at that point. And he didn't know language. That's how good he was. And the guy that came with me is like, man, I've heard you talk about this stuff, but to see it, to hear it coming from their mouth and to see how they tie things together, all of a sudden it's like the lights turn on as to why you need to know this and need to know this and how this fits with that and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so I think I can present Dale Tuggy's arguments with far more interest and passion than Dale Tuggy can. Okay. Seriously. It's like, dude, caffeine, something. It's just sort of like, I can't do caffeine. Caffeine would kill me. But anyway, that heart stuff. Yeah. No caffeine for me. It'll go fast enough all on its own. But yeah, I'm looking forward to diving into this stuff because, you know, basically his argument was that our key texts all have textual issues. They're obscure. They're not clear. That the clear and easy understanding is the Unitarian understanding. The Trinitarian understanding is the you have to accept this. And there's all these problems with it. And when Craig did force him to deal with certain texts, I have never heard a coherent, convincing explanation of John 20:28. And I've talked to a lot of Unitarians, Jehovah's Witnesses, Muslims, you name it. And Tuggy's answer for HaKoreas Mu Kai HaTheas Mu, my Lord and my God, was that Thomas was saying the same thing that Paul would say when he said, God was by means of Christ reconciling the world to himself. My Lord Jesus and my God, God the Father working through Jesus, was his explanation. Now, that's not going to stand up to the text. Ha kurias mu kai ha theas mu. They have the exact same object. You cannot separate them at all. But if you've never heard someone spin something like that, it can, you know, you can be like, I've not heard that. How do I give a proper response to that? You know, it can end a conversation, you know, that type of thing. So I think going through this will be helpful for folks. You know, it takes time to put this stuff together, obviously. And I don't have a production staff. It's me and Rich. So when I play videos, when I play audios, I've done all that editing. I've found the programs like Audio Note Taker and Note Studio and stuff like that. And I've dumped the videos in or the audios in and gone through it. It takes hours to prep that kind of stuff. But it works. And you want something scary? Here's something scary. When I was in Tullahoma, which is where Jeffrey Rice is, this guy came up to me at the conference and he said, I want to show you something. And he starts showing me this. He has access to an AI. I don't know how to describe it, but an AI indexing program. And it can listen to audio and Index Audio. And they're almost done, because then I connected him up with my tech people. They're almost done. Soon you will be able to search everything I've ever said on the Dividing Line since 1998, every debate, and all my sermons on Sermon Audio. That's scary.
Wow.
That is absolutely scary for me. I mean, really, would you like someone to be able to check out everything you've said for that many years?
Burn the books.
Burn the recording.
Yeah. But actually, you know, when you think about it, the people are always contacting me going, you know, I know you've addressed this on the Dividing Line. And I go, I know I have. I have no earthly idea when. I wouldn't know how to find it.
Yeah.
Oh, when you. Maybe it'll be worthwhile. But man, on the okay. That's like having a wife whose memory is absolutely perfect. My fellow elder at my previous church, his wife's memory is infallible. It's frightening. And I don't know that I'd want to be married to someone whose memory is absolutely perfect. That'd be rough.
Well, hey, Jason, do you have anything to pop in? Any thoughts, any questions for Dr. White? Just talking about this first kind of issue that we brought up here.
Yes, I have some thoughts. Perhaps it's a little more simplistic than what you're talking about, Dr. White, but I want us to think about biblical illiteracy, whether it be the pulpit or the pew, in terms of what we see in our culture. You know, we've talked about technology, and we've talked about how that has influenced us so much. I mean, we're able to do this Zoom podcast episode because of technology, and all that's good. But at the same time, I think this is the premise of David Gordon's book, Why Johnny Can't Preach, is we have a generation of young men that are coming to the seminary who have been influenced, impacted by technology in a negative way. In other words, we don't read, the common people don't read, and they don't write. And because they don't read and they don't write, then listening to a sermon or even preparing a sermon and writing your ideas down and being able to communicate that sermon in a way that the people respond, we're getting worse and worse at doing that, I'm afraid. And I think that biblical illiteracy is a result of a culture that wants to do everything by soundbite and by text message. And nobody writes letters anymore. Nobody really reads books anymore. Nobody has personal libraries. The three of us do. We love books. We have more than we could ever house. I've got them all over the church building. But the common people, and this is not a derogatory comment toward anybody, but that's my fear. I fear that we have the lack of biblical understanding and literacy in some degree because people don't read, people don't write. And so putting those two things together makes a biblically illiterate society.
You know, I years ago, I got to visit up in New England, a museum that had a bunch of Jonathan Edwards stuff in it. And they had some of his sermon notes. And they brought him out, and I'm looking at them, and I was younger then, so I could still, you know, I can't read small print anymore at all. It's very frustrating. That's why I'm looking for large print Hebrew Bibles, I guess. And I couldn't even then I couldn't read it. I don't know how anyone could have written in a font that small, because when you magnify it, it's perfectly legible. And they're just these tiny little pieces of paper with this beautiful cursive, but tiny, tiny writing on it. And there's a lot of theories, because there's no way standing in a pulpit, you could have read that. It's just too small. So why'd he do it? And, you know, obviously one of the theories is that it was the writing of it out that allowed him to then memorize it for the preaching. It's possible, I guess. But as I was driving over today, I was listening to a book. That's how it's interesting. There you go. I wasn't reading a book. The vast majority of the books that I read today, I listen to, because I'm on the road. So I'm either on bike or on the road. And I probably listen to 40 books a year, audio wise.
But you've grown up reading, Dr. White. Reading is what has made you who you are. But yeah, I understand.
Yeah, but once you get into your seventh decade, you sit down to read a book and you wake up the next morning.
I know. That happens in your sixth decade.
it's just how it works. So anyway, one of the things that the author was saying in the book, he was talking about how a lot of studies have demonstrated that the way you learn impacts the way that you think, and how technology has changed all of that, so that when people did read, they had much longer attention spans. And when they would write things out, that in many instances in centuries past, you wouldn't even be considered prepared for pastoral duties if you didn't have the Psalms memorized. Right. All of them.
Right.
That he gave the illustration of the Lincoln-Douglas debate, and that Douglas had done a 3-hour opening statement in that debate. And then they turned it over to Lincoln, and Lincoln said, "I think we should take a break for dinner and come back." They did, and he gave a 4-hour opening statement. That's what debates were like. And people could sit there and listen for 3 and 4 hours. And that was only in the 1850s. That would never happen today. No. That would never happen today.
No.
So when we talk about, you know, it's not just biblical illiteracy. This nation, at the same time the Lincoln-Douglas debates are going on, almost any person in this nation had learned to read by reading the Bible. They knew all the stories of the Bible. You could use Jonah or whatever story from the Old Testament, and the pagan walking down the street, there weren't very many of them, but the non-church attending person would still know what you were talking about, because it was the common knowledge of the people. And the vast majority of evangelicals and churches don't know any of that stuff.
No.
Even when they do read the Bible, it's very briefly, it's couched in entertainment.
Yes.
It's very rarely as a part of a flow of a narrative story at all. And so that's why people struggle to find stuff, because they don't know where it is in the narrative, in the flow of, you know, which chapter, you know, why is it important that the blind man is where he is in John. Most people don't know where he is in John. But that's between the leaders who picked up stones to stone him in John chapter 8, the I am, and then John chapter 10. And here in between is the healing of the blind man. And they don't even know where the flow is. And most preaching doesn't identify where it is either. Right. Because you don't have enough time to. Most of our sermons, you know, I give Jeff a lot of grief, because I know that, for example, the week before he went on sabbatical, his sermon that week was an hour and 20 minutes long. And I think the next week I did 53, and we actually got out on time. But an hour and 20 minutes was nothing. That would have been a, that would have been a sermonette, you know, only a couple centuries ago. And so, yeah, things are, have changed a lot. And you can always tell, you can, when you're listening to certain people, their ability to provide biblical examples that are actually accurate and useful and communicate something, that that's, those are the people that have been spending a lot of time in that word, and probably not spending nearly as much time in electronic form.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I hear all that, but at the same time I go, yeah, you need to have your paper Bibles. The you don't want to trust the regime with being able to alter the text or deleting your Bible or stuff like that. All that stuff is possibility. Yeah, you want to have paper Bible stuff.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is we've got to deal with the culture that we're a part of. And right now, the educational system is not producing people that that can read for any period of time at all.
Right.
And, you know, you think back, why are there stained glass windows in medieval churches? Because no one could read. Well, not no one, but most people couldn't. You know, you look at the medieval period, someone born in Europe during the medieval period, in general, did not travel more than 7 miles any one direction from where they were born in their entire life. So you could draw a circle with a 14-mile diameter, and that was their world. That's all they knew. And most of them just scratched out a meager living. Most women had to have 10 live children to have one survive to adulthood. It was a different world. And so if you couldn't read, and in many areas, even the priests couldn't read, the only way to tell stories was visually. So it's not the first time, but now it's not because of a lack of education. It's because of the mechanism of education doesn't produce long-term capacity to really engage in in-depth thought and reading and contemplation and things like that. So it's a little different situation. So we can bemoan that reality, but the question is, okay, but then how do you take someone from the American educational system? You know, my grandkids, they're eating books up because they're being homeschooled. So they're encouraged. Take all the time you want. Read. Go. That's wonderful. But the people coming out of the public schools, what do you, you're telling them to do something that their brain has been trained not to do. You know, even when you tell them, well, look, turn everything off and just sit down and focus in. And 5 minutes in, they're wondering what's going on Facebook. You know, where's my phone? And they're not following the narrative anymore, because that's how they've been trained to do things.
Right.
And same way with communicating to other people. Like you said, who's written a letter? I actually had a bill recently where the company had no online ability to pay it. I had to send them a check. I mean, do you know the last time I had checks printed? I mean, wow. And then I'm ripping the house apart looking for a stamp. I mean, yeah. Talk about old school, you know?
Hey, you're speaking Jason's language here.
I still write my sermons on a yellow legal pad and a pencil.
He writes everything. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, that's perfectly fine. Most everybody knows I almost never use notes. I try. Notes for me are the original text. So if I'm it, for me, the my best sermons are when I just have a Greek text or Hebrew text or something like that, and allow the text to be the commentary. There are some, generally, if I'm doing a topical sermon and I need to be covering a bunch of different texts at the same time, then I'll have notes. But even then, you know what I like to use for my notes? The Remarkable tablet, which if you've used it, is close to writing. Like when I'm in debates, that's what I use. Because then I can convert that directly to digital afterwards. It does struggle with what, when I'm writing during a debate, my writing is not getting better with age. In fact, when I write James now, the E is gone. I mean, do you have any idea how many thousands of books I've signed over the past 20 years? And now, as I sign James, it comes out jams. The E just disappears. It's like my hand no longer wants to put the E in there. It's really weird. I'm sure that probably is, there's some neurologist out there going, oh, I know what's coming for him. And, okay, probably you do. But, my writing isn't all that good, but that's still what I use during debates. Because I can literally move stuff around if I need to, right, as I'm taking notes. But that's something, for example, people struggle with that when they do debates. That's not, I don't know all that many people to do them, but my son-in-law recently did his first debate. I thought he did a really, really good job. In fact,
by the way, I've watched that debate.
I was going to ask you. Watch it.
Yeah, I did. I thought he did a very good job. Truth be known, I don't think that the other guy gave him much to debate against. I'm that's just me as a passive.
Well, I love Zach. Zach Lautenschlager is a wonderful guy. He's a member of he's a member of the OPC in Salt Lake. I've worked with them for years and years. Did you see the last debate that Jeff and I did with the two guys on ethics and God?
Yes.
Okay. Jason Wallace, the moderator, is Zach's pastor.
Oh, okay.
So there's the connection.
Yeah.
And Jason and I have been doing stuff up there in Salt Lake City for literally about 23 years, I think. And so I love Zach, but look, I guess it's perfectly all right for me to say that I am so proud of Eric.
He did a very good job. He was well prepared.
Yes, Eric knows more about covenant theology than I do, or that I ever will. He is a voracious reader and a voracious listener. But what's more than that, he's an incredibly hard worker.
Hmm.
And I cannot imagine anyone that I would want taking care of my daughter and my grandkids than Eric Yeager. I am so proud of that young man. He's great.
Go back just a little bit, because I don't want to sound like I'm against technology, because I'm not.
No.
Most of the time I preach, what I preached with yesterday was not with notes, but with my outline. Most of the time that I preach, it's on a sticky note, and that's the extent of my notes. So my concern is more of the preacher side of this. If we're sending young men to seminaries who can't really read and write as we have in the past, then how does the seminary take that man and help him to become one who is articulate and can use the language and communicate in a way in which the people are engaged? That's where we're losing the battle. If the people aren't engaged with the scripture, they're not hearing the gospel articulated.
Yeah, obviously, my understanding at that point is it is a long-term giving of example that I know Jeff and I do most of the preaching. Luke and Zach do some preaching as well, but it's primarily Jeff and I that do the preaching at Apologia. And Jeff will tell you that I was one of the primary influences on him as a young man. So in fact, the first book he read as a Christian after his conversion was the King James Only Controversy. And I've always said, that's not the first book I'd recommend to anybody after conversion, but that's okay.
Interesting.
But so we have similar styles. And so there is a, and this goes back to when I was at PRBC as well. It is teaching by example from the pulpit. Consistency, week after week.
Yes.
Making sure to explain. Now we have a challenge that you don't have. You have your own building. So you can set your own schedule. We do not have our own building. We grew a lot starting in 2020. In fact, one of our biggest struggles right now is we're in a building that the main sanctuary seats 400-ish, but we have to have an overflow set up. And we're struggling with the overflow because a lot of the people feel like if they're watching something on a screen, they're not really there. And we're struggling
with how to... Which, by the way, is a really interesting thing to bring into the conversation, because the same folks who would be saying that are the same folks who are likely just immersed in technology, but yet are not wanting to watch the sermon live on a screen, right?
Right.
It's a really interesting
interesting
thing to think about.
I think most people recognize there's a difference between, if I'm preaching, I can see you.
Yes.
If you're in the other room, I can't see you. And so things do break up. Now, we have the Lord's Supper each Sunday. And so they come in and they participate with us in the supper and stuff like that, but they can't be there for the singing. They can't be there for the preaching. And it really does make a difference in that. So back to what you were saying, it would seem to me that while a homiletics professor can lay out how to communicate, one of the problems that we face is the mixture of the people we have in the church.
Yes. Yes.
We have people who can listen to a sermon for a long period of time. If you come to Apologia, you've got to be able to go minimally an hour and sometimes an hour and a half. Because that's not unusual. They ruin me too. I go over an hour now as well, almost always. But then you've got people, they want that. And then you got new people that aren't used to that. And you've got some people that bring a paper Bible and some people only have an electronic Bible. And you've got such a mixture.
True.
That, one thing you can't do is become overly concerned about what take visitors have.
True. Yeah.
You've got to be primarily aimed at the people that are coming regularly.
Yeah.
Are they getting a regular diet to where they are being led to understand what we are teaching them by how we are handling the scripture and by how we continually bring in, see how this connects with that. And this theme connects with that theme and that type of stuff. But so many churches are focused primarily upon, what's a visitor going to see? Well, okay, I get that. I don't want a visitor to feel like, oh, I have no idea what's going on here. I'm out of here. But at the same time, you want your members, the people that are coming and committed, you want them to be over time being taught how to do biblical study and biblical theology.
Yes.
See all this stuff, and to do it because they've seen it being done from the pulpit consistently on all sorts of different topics.
Yeah,
that's right.
All sorts of different issues. So yeah. That I think that's the best you can do, and that's why seminaries again need to be pretty much focused upon local churches, because you can't, you, the way the seminary model works is you rip your young men out of the local churches, ship them off someplace else, and debt them to their eyeballs, and they never come back. So the, I don't see that in New Testament, but that's how we've been doing it for a long time.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And I do think, you know, my own seminary experience, I appreciate, I loved it. There was benefit to me. However, I think that what you just said is spot on. And even in our congregation, I can tell the years of expositorily trying to preach faithfully, and not that I'm some great preacher or the expert, but trying to just do that faithfully has made a difference in the way that others have been raised up to try to mimic that and to communicate that well. So I think you're right. And
but it takes time. It takes a long time. That's not a microwave solution, right? It's a right. It's more of crock pot style.
Right.
Years of being fed sound sermons, expository sermons. And then over time, you as a church member learn how to read and how to eat your Bible, as it were, right? Is that what you're talking about, Dr. White, basically?
Well, yeah. And that's how, instead of just having a sermon every 6 months on proper hermeneutic methodology, it just needs to be consistently done in every sermon.
It's better modeled than
taught.
It needs
to be laid out. Right, right. Well, and you do both. I mean,
well, sure, sure.
Jeff and I will both, you know, make specific, because, you know, the whole name of the church is apologia, for crying out loud. So there's always, you know, our illustrations are probably really heavy with apologetic stuff. Our constant outreach to Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses and all that kind of stuff. But we are teaching it, and then we're modeling it in our application, because you can't just do sermon after sermon after sermon on systematic theology. You have to have application. I mean, right now Jeff's going through Proverbs. Man, that's tough. Don Fry did that at PRBC. And after about, I don't know, chapter 12 or so, how do you even do that? It a lot of it becomes repetitive, and there aren't a whole, it becomes just one verse, there isn't necessarily a connection in the later collections of Proverbs. It gets really challenging, really, really hard. So when I had the opportunity of preaching a couple of weeks ago, Jeff was like, well, hey, I'm going to be in Proverbs 10 if you want to pick up. And I'm like, no, thank you.
Been there, done that.
No, I'm going to leave that to you. If you can do Proverbs, congratulations, man. You're a better man than I. I went topical and did the letter to the Ephesians. I thought that well, in Revelation chapter 2, Jesus's letter to the Ephesians. Any one of those letters to the churches are just amazing material.
I think what we're saying too is the local church ought to be the seedbed for training men up to preach and putting them in places and opportunities. You know, my seminary experience, I probably preached twice, and that's counting my master's work and my doctoral work. I didn't learn to preach in the seminary. I learned to preach in the pulpit of this church and the previous church and the one before that. But the point being, I think that we're saying that's what we need to do, is create an opportunity within the local church where we're raising up men, we're encouraging men to follow their giftedness and their callingness and calling into pulpit ministry. And I guess we could talk about it all night, and perhaps, Duffy, you're feeling like we need to move on, but...
Well, no, I think it's good, and what we'll probably do is we'll finish up with this, and then since we've gone pretty long here, we'll go ahead and end with this, and maybe in the future we can have Dr. White on again at some point and talk about some other stuff. But I think this is
when I'm at a location that has a better internet connection, so we can.
No, it's okay.
Because I had all this stuff planned, you know, multiple cameras, and I could pop up accordance and do all sorts of stuff like this, and here I am sitting with my laptop camera, and I'm just
hey, okay, brother. Dr. White. Thank you. Dr. White, a lot of times one of our elders and I, we joke, it's first world probs.
yeah, very much first world prob. But yeah, but when you gotta understand how many people have an RV with a studio in it. I mean, this was the bedroom. So I sleep in the bunks in the back.
Oh, nice.
So I've sacrificed a lot of comfort.
Wow.
To have this. So I'm literally sitting in a chair, which would have been smack dab in the middle of a queen size bed. And when I look around here, everything we've done, it really is cool to be able to throw accordions up. And so let's see, look at this, and here's this, and change the angle. I could be looking over this direction, and I've got lights back here, and I've been doing all this work, putting this stuff up here. And yeah, so
well,
we'll make it work.
It looks great from this angle.
Yeah. Well, okay. I appreciate it, guys. I'm sorry to talk so long, but we'll get a chance to. I'm sure Tom Buck will eventually want me to come back again. I don't know the way he's been having Daryl Harrison and everybody over there. It's like, hey, I don't think I've ever even preached a Sunday morning sermon there. It's like, oh, wow.
I'll have to talk with him about that.
I'm starting to feel a little unloved. I really am.
Yeah, Daryl was there the whole weekend a couple weekends ago.
I know. And that's not the first time. So it's like, okay, fine. I'm getting the message.
Okay. All right.
It's sad.
Well, hey, I know you've had a long day on the road and issues with the KOA and all that fun stuff. You need to get a good night's rest. And it's been a good, just get to hear you discuss some important issues. Thank you for agreeing to do this. We certainly want to wish you a safe rest of your trip. Jason, do you have any closing words, anything at all before we wrap the podcast up today?
No, just thank you, Dr. White. I know that we enjoyed you being at our church in person, December of 2022, and then to follow it up with this podcast is a treat. And so thank you for taking the time, and I look forward to other opportunities to have more discussions like this.
Well, I know where Emory is now. So, I understand there's actually more than one RV park around. So maybe next time
that would be correct.
We can go the one that has lights.
Let me know and I'll help you locate one.
Sounds good.
Well, that's it for today's episode, folks. Thank you once again for taking your time to listen to the Asking for a Friend podcast or watch if you're on YouTube. We hope it's been a blessing to you. Don't forget, before you go, like or share the podcast either through Podbean if you're listening audio, or if you're on YouTube, share the link to somebody, maybe on Facebook, social media, however you share that. Please get that out there. We always would appreciate others to listen to this. And lastly, if you ever have a question you'd like for us to answer or address on the podcast at a future date, you can go to our website, bbcemory.org. Go to the media tab, scroll to the bottom, and there's a place where you can submit us a question. So until next time, as usual, grace and peace be with you all.